This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hey, it's Gemma Spegg, host of the Open Mind Original podcast, Mantra. Every Monday, I'll bring you a new mantra, a simple yet powerful phrase to help you clear your mind and stay grounded amidst the chaos. I'll also share some personal stories, journal prompts, and a weekly challenge to bring each mantra to life. Follow and listen to Mantra, an Audacy podcast in partnership with Open Mind Studios, available now on the free Audacy app and wherever you get your podcasts.
6:14 now, chilly. Chillier than it was yesterday, for sure. They talk about March coming in like a lamb or a lion, but in this case, spring, which started a little bit more than 2 hours ago, is coming in like a lion. Highs today of only 61. That's going to be around 6 o'clock this afternoon before the sun sets. Right now, it's 53. Tomorrow, nice. Highs of 67, plenty of sunshine for the weekend. 74, 76 for highs, respectively, after starts in the 50s. Maybe a couple of clouds on Sunday, but still spring-like, and you got to get out and enjoy these days because they are dwindling down to a precious few as the heat and humidity of summertime approaches. It'll be here. Dane Ciolino joins us now, our friend, professor of law at Loyola. Talk about the judge putting a pause on the city council's travel ban after the mayor filed the lawsuit. How you doing, Dane?
Just fine, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Does this go to the city charter? Who has responsibility, or who can tell who what? Who's the boss of who, maybe, is what I'm trying to say in layman's terms?
Yeah, the mayor and her lawyers are arguing that the home rule charter of the city of New Orleans prohibits the council from at this stage in the budgeting process interfering or on a temporary basis telling her she cannot spend funds that have been budgeted already. It's a very very detailed lawsuit that they have gotten some success with so far, because a duty judge temporarily restrained the council from enforcing that ordinance against her with respect to travel. There's going to be a full-blown hearing next week as to whether or not that temporary restraining order should be turned into a preliminary injunction or a permanent injunction eventually.
So it would seem like whether the mayor's got a little bit of time in office or not, it doesn't matter. The council should have always been, and I might be wrong in this, I'm just wondering, the council should have always been able to tell the mayor if she can't travel or not pay for expenses, or take me through this, Dan, because I'm confused. What would change as far as the time frame of it?
Yeah, it is a little confusing and surprising that the mayor is going through all this trouble for this. This is usually kind of a political squabble or issue that's sorted out in the legislative process. And, of course, historically, the legislative branch of any government holds the purse strings and decides how what money is going to what of the people's money is going to be spent. But here she doesn't like what the city council has done and argued that they essentially are usurping her executive power by telling her how to spend money that's already been budgeted to her office.
So the mayor has lawyers from Phelps Dunbar, as well as the former Entergy CEO Charles Rice, whom I've met a couple of times, defending her. He said he assumed he was brought in because he's familiar with the council and the mayor's legal battles. One question, again, I have as a layman is, when it comes to Phelps Dunbar, I'll due respect, of course, and to Charles Rice, they're just doing their jobs. Who's paying for that? The city?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That was a question. That was a question that popped immediately to my mind. Typically, the city attorney's office would be involved in something like this. And it's quite surprising to see a private law firm and, you know, really capable but expensive lawyers handling the suit. There's some chance that they're not charging the mayor. That's a possibility. I don't think it's likely. But in order to pay private contractors like this, there's an appropriations process that needs to go through with approval by purchasing. So, yeah, that's a big question in my head. Who's paying for this? If anybody, if the firm's doing it pro bono for the mayor, then that's one thing. But if somehow city funds are being used to pay for this, that's a more difficult issue.
And again, I have no, I'm not trying to cast aspersions on anybody at all. But if it is being done pro bono, then you would have to worry about whomever is doing business with the city or the mayor about conflicts, right? Because pro bono is one thing if you're doing it for somebody that's destitute or somebody that can't afford counsel. Take me through that process, Dane, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't really trouble me a lot. I mean, because lawyers do a lot of pro bono and public interest work for little or no pay. That's not something that's terribly uncommon. So, you know, again, I just don't. I guess we need more facts. Yeah.
I guess what I'm wondering is, a friend of mine does estate law and wrote a couple of books on it, and he says, kind of, you know, he tells the kid, he figures out, or at least or realized after a long time that, you know, after the kids quit squabbling about the estate and fighting each other, and he gets paid after anything, if there's anything left, they can have it. And it just seems like, and he's not doing anything wrong. I'm just saying that, you know, people sometimes get caught up in legal proceedings and they're more concerned with winning than the amount of money at hand. And I'm just wondering if the city doesn't wind up spending a lot more money on this if they are paying for Phelps Dunbar, Charles Rice, whomever, and the city winds up spending a lot more than the mayor would have spent traveling. You see where I'm going with that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think that's why it's a, you know, it's a very valid question to ask who's paying for this litigation, because it is, it does seem to be much ado over a plane trip.
And I know a lot of politics are involved here, and politics actually happen, you know, believe it or not, happens between the city and the city council and the mayor. But I'm just wondering, while the taxpayers are picking again teams, you know, I'm going to win team mayor, team council. Let's look at what we're paying in free agency for all of this. 620, more with Dane Ciolino when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our other friend, Dane Ciolino, professor of law at Loyola, about a judge and a temporary restraining order about Mayor Cantrell's travel and whether or not we're spending, or the taxpayers are spending, a whole lot more than the mayor would have spent traveling. Dane, when it comes to the actual legal.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code SHAVE at checkout. That's harrys.com, code SHAVE. Enjoy.
Maneuverings on this. So the council at some point decided, that's it, we're not going to pay for the mayor's travel anymore, right? And the mayor went to court and said that you're overreaching. I'm trying to get back to the basics of this, that you're overreaching and this is against the city charter.
Yeah, and of course, as you may recall, politically, this council did that when the mayor decided not to allocate money to the school board because the city was in her view, bad financial shape. And the council responded essentially by saying, if the city is in bad financial shape, then you shouldn't be spending city funds to go on trips. and they passed the ordinance, and it was unanimous. Oddly enough, she didn't veto the ordinance, as of course she could under the Home Rule Charter, and go through the political process to try to undo an ordinance that she was unhappy with. Instead, she went to the court system. I guess she saw the writing on the wall, since it was a unanimous ordinance, that her veto would quickly be overridden by the council. So she is essentially asking this. She, in a TRO application last week, she asked the judge to temporarily ban the council from enforcing that ordinance against her with regard to her travel. And next week, Judge Kern Reese is going to hold a full-blown hearing on whether or not the council's ordinance violates the Home Rule Charter, because it usurps her executive authority as the chief executive officer of the city.
And I know you didn't come on and talk about this, but the school board thing is something else that's working its way through the courts, and we'll talk to Joe Geruso about that later. That's not linked legally to this, but politically to this. Would that be accurate?
That's 100% accurate, yes.
So it was a result of the mayor making her decision with that school board case that led the council politically to say, fine, as you just said, you don't have the money for that, then you don't have the money, then we don't have the money for this.
Exactly. And now somehow somebody's got the money for the lawyers to fight all this out in civil district court.
Nothing against lawyers. I'm not criticizing lawyers. I wish I could have been one myself. Let's talk about this temporary restraining order, how this is likely to play out, because Judge Marissa Hudibarrat, if I'm pronouncing that right, granted the TRO, but a different judge gets to decide on whether or not, I don't know, tell me about how that process plays out.
Yeah, under the Louisiana Code of Civil Procedure, you can go ex parte, which is all by yourself, to a judge, which the mayor and her lawyers did, and temporarily put some action on hold. But it's only temporary. It'll only last for 10 days. And then there needs to be an adversarial, full-blown evidentiary hearing where the other side gets to put on their evidence. Now, the interesting thing is going to be who's going to show up to defend the city council and the ordinance. Typically, the city attorney's office would do that. I presume they will in this case, because their attorney, client is the city, not the mayor. I presume the city attorney's office is going to show up and argue against the mayor on this. That's why they're not involved in the first place, because of that conflict of interest, and the mayor had to go out and hire outside counsel to handle her case.
So the city attorney represents both the council and the mayor, and I'm correct?
Technically, the city attorney's office represents the city of New Orleans, the entity. None of the particular constituents or players, but the city itself.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and in this case, the city council, through the ordinary political processes set forth in the Home Rule Charter, has enacted an ordinance. The ordinance was not vetoed by the mayor, so it's part of the law of the city. And whether it violates the Home Rule Charter is something that typically the city attorney would go to court and argue in support of the ordinance. But that's going to be directly contrary to what the city attorney's boss, the mayor, wants to happen. So that's why I think it's going to be interesting to see who shows up in support of the city and how vigorously they advance the council's position on this as opposed to the mayor's.
It's not beyond the realm of belief to think that the mayor could have gone to the city attorney's office, pleaded her case. They said, you're wrong. And she said, okay, I'll get outside counsel.
That very well could have happened.
Gotcha. Thank you, Dane. Appreciate it as always. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, always there when we need him. 6:30. We'll talk to Mike Strain when we come back. Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry right now. Time for WWL First News. 6:45, quarter till 7, Thursday morning. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Man, we love this time of week, we get to talk to Mike Strain. the Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, so many things under his purview. How you doing, Mike Strain?
Man, I am doing excellent. It's strawberry season. It's crawfish season. The shrimp are nice. The weather's getting better. We're getting crops in the ground. Look, it's a great day.
And I should mention,
spend half a day yesterday on the strawberry farms.
And I should mention skilled veterinarian as well, a well-respected veterinarian on the North Shore, Dr. Mike Strain. Tell me about strawberries. How are they looking?
Oh, they are looking really, really nice. We were at the Harris Farm and at Liuza's yesterday. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a good crop. They're coming on. They're really nice. I had to bring some samples home. It takes a lot of testing, you know,
absolutely,
for the market research.
Oh, yeah. And, it's just your job, Mike. You're just doing your job, and God bless you for doing it.
You got to make sure the strawberries are right now, mm-hmm, you know, and it takes more than one clamshell. But you can buy strawberries. You can go to Rouse's there, right at $4.99 a clamshell. And, of course, we have the Strawberry Festival coming up April 11th through 13th. Have you ever been to the Strawberry Festival?
I have. It's a long time ago, but I can only imagine how much bigger it is now.
It's incredible. I mean, you go to the parade, there'll be 100,000 people out there on the parade, and strawberries, you're just everywhere. Now, this Saturday, we're going to have Strawberry Day at the park, Julian Dufresh Park. It's a wonderful day, and there'll be an old car show, and then there'll be, you know, strawberries being cooked. It's a lot of fun there as well, and that is actually this Saturday. And of course, normally we have the auction around 3 o'clock or so. We'll have the strawberry auction, but it's going to be a lot of fun as well. So it's strawberry time. They're really doing well. The farmers are working so very hard to have the finest strawberries. And as they said yesterday when we met with them, and we were there was a legislative delegation, the House and Senate Agricultural Committees, led by their chairman. And this was orchestrated by Senator Bill Wheat, who is one of our local senators here. And we met with the farmers. We went out on the farms. They actually had us picking strawberries. And, of course, those are some of the ones that we brought home, the ones that we picked and of course, had to sample. But talking about, you know, they really put their heart and their soul in these strawberries. You know, so when you pick up these strawberries, you know, it's a part of culture. And many of these farmers are third and fourth generation strawberry farmers. That's why our strawberries are so much better than what you get, you know, out of, Mexico or Florida or California, because it's the heart and soul of Louisiana, you know, in these berries. And you can taste it. But again, buy these local berries, support our local farmers, because it's a big deal here. And it's been going on. You know, strawberries have been part of our culture now more than 100 years, and it started off in Uncle Sam, Louisiana, which is now called Independence. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, the strawberries were first brought here by Dr. Wilson, who was Justin Wilson's Wilson's father, Justin Wilson's grandfather. Yeah, introduced the strawberries, and it was right in the late, like, 1890s, when the whole economy was struggling, you know, right after the Civil War, they came in, and first it was timber. They cut all the timber. Then they said, now what do we do? And they really didn't find anything that worked well. And there they started planting strawberries because it was on the line of the railroad, and they could put them on the railroad and move them across the country. And that was where the strawberries began in what was then called Uncle Sam, which is now Independence, Louisiana, and Dr. Wilson. And that was Harry D. Wilson, who was the commissioner of agriculture, you know, back in the day with Earl K. Long, on the ticket with Earl Long. And that's Justin Wilson's father, started strawberries in Louisiana. So a lot of culture and history there.
You teach me something I never knew every time we talked to you. You said clamshell. Is that what you call the thing you put strawberries
in? Yeah, we call them clamshells. You know,
that's a little green
little
container?
Wooden, little green or clear. Yep, uh-huh. Yep, we call them clamshells.
I'll be darned.
Yep. And that's all right. And they're about 16 ounces, and they're $4.99 there at Rouse's. And I'm looking at some. I got some right now, and it's hard to talk to you and eat these at the same time. I may have to try it, but they're really nice.
All right, let me get to this. New York Times, Robert F. Kennedy saying that instead of culling birds when the infection is discovered, farmers should consider maybe the possibility of letting it run through the flock so that we can identify the birds, preserve the birds that are immune to it. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, there might be two chickens left when it's over. You know, I mean, it's going to go. And so what happens when it goes through the flock, it will destroy the entire flock in, you know, in less than 2 days. They will all die. The other thing is that it generates so much virus. We know that if we have a poultry farm that gets infected, if we don't shut off the fan, those birds can infect another poultry farm within 8 to 10 miles. I'm going to repeat that. They can infect another farm within 8 to 10 miles because there's a massive amount of virus there, and it will aerosolize. And so the reason we go in and, you know, and euthanize those chickens so fast is to stop the spread of the disease. In limited circumstances, with high degree of biosecurity, they've only been able to take out, you know, one or two of the barns where the chickens are, the chicken houses, and maybe save some on the other farm. But just letting it run its course, there's going to be a massive amount of virus. In addition to that, the more virus that is there, then you have a greater chance of the virus mutating.
Yep.
The virus has to be dealt with quickly, and we have and that thought of just waiting to see if you can have natural selection, and then and if you have a few broilers, then you're going to have to, you know, that survive, a few hens, and then you survive to breed them out to where you have a resistant bird, and the numbers that you need will take an extraordinary amount of time.
And what would happen to the price of chicken and eggs? The price of chicken and eggs in the meantime, while that played out.
Well, there won't be any chicken and eggs if you do that.
Right.
You know, that's the bottom line. If you look at right now, we have about 300 million hens that lay eggs. We lost 30 million so far. So we've lost over 10% of the flock. Just in the last 30 days, we've lost about 8.9 million additional birds. And right now, there is we just notified within a week that there is an affected house in Mississippi, not around any other houses. The bottom line is that you know, just say, look, let it run its course. That's not going to work. We had developed chickens that were naturally resistant to avian influenza more than 10 to 15 years ago. Now, they were genetically modified, but they were not put into production for that reason, because they were genetically modified. We had developed lines of chickens that would do that. By selective breeding, I know that that is an effort, but that takes a long, long, long time because, again, we have to have 330 million chickens. We can replace the entire flock with resistant ones, but you can't let this disease run. We've got to stop it, you know, biosecurity. And at the end of the day, I'm going to tell you, I'm an advocate of vaccinating our birds. We vaccinate our chickens for many different diseases currently. We vaccinate our cattle herds for many different diseases. And we need just to add this one more into the group of diseases we're vaccinating for and stop this.
And before we run out of time, just scientifically, because we've already, I think, pretty well established, that's just a dumb idea. That's just, you probably shouldn't have said it because it just makes no sense. But when it comes to, even if you were to do that, then another virus could come along and you're right back to where you started, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. But the thing with this, but just logistically, it doesn't work. We've got to stop this disease when we've got to, because again, it's not going away. And the disease is prevalent within the wildlife, in and around everywhere. That's the thing. You know, these additional houses that are coming online, if they are not in vicinity of another house or a dairy that has the disease, it's coming from wildlife. Mainly now the geese. This is a goose farm. And if you're here in Louisiana, you know, we have reports and we know it's in the geese, it's in the teal. And of course, the only way to stop it there is biosecurity, but at the end of the day, vaccination. And the discussion that if we vaccinate, then we could create birds that that would spread the disease. We've been vaccinating, you know, animals and people, you know, for centuries. And that is not the case. It doesn't develop, you know, super viruses. It stops the virus that we are fighting, and then if the viruses do try to adapt, we modify the vaccine to attack that, and we're on a consistent vaccination basis.
Mike,
so whenever
Strain,
you face with a disease, you got to deal with it.
We're out of time. I'm glad we have you, sir. Thank you for for being you. Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Go eat some strawberries for me, would you please?
I am. I've got a big red one right here. I'm going to crunch down, and I'm going to be thinking about you a little
Have
bit
at it.
While I'm eating.
Thank you. Put them on some pancakes. All right. Thank you, Mike Strain. 656 traffic quickly, WWL.